your kind of Board of the Furniture and Sanitary and Environmental Affairs Committee, but this is the first time we've come here. My colleagues here with me, I'm the Executive Director of the Centre. My colleagues here with me is Sylvia Kamanjo, who is an attorney in our Pollution and Climate Change Program, and Tabogo Tebogodi behind me, who is one of our candidate attorneys. They have told me that next time they're going to present in my place, so I guess this is my first and last time before this committee, which is quite exciting. Just a few words about the Centre for Environmental Rights. I'm sure a lot of the members here will not be familiar with our work. We are a non-profit organisation and law clinic that works to advance environmental rights in South Africa as guaranteed in Section 24 of the Constitution. We work in environmental rights, mining, do a lot of work around transparency issues, pollution and climate change and water governance. As I said, we do both advocacy like we're here today, but we also represent clients who cannot afford legal services from private attorneys as a law clinic. So that's also how we gain a lot of our experience around these matters. Our comments that we make today are endorsed by two other non-profit organizations, the Environmental Monitoring Group and the Federation for a Sustainable Environment. Last year was a very heavy year of law reform in our sector, so we tended to band together a lot and support each other's submissions. We had a lot of change in the mining sector and in the environmental sphere. In terms of the documents, I think we've handed out a PowerPoint presentation, but we also made quite a detailed written submission in November, at document 11, that I'll be referring to in this presentation. So a summary of the submission that we made. First of all, that as the Centre for Environmental Rights and the other two non-profit organisations that we work with, in the submission, we very expressly support streamlined and integrated approval processes. We think that that's in the interest of the public, of government in achieving its relevant objectives, but it's also in the interest of communities and affected parties who have to participate in these processes and are trying to exercise their rights of participation. It's a very heavy burden on those institutions and communities and individuals to participate in multiple and non-integrated approval processes. So we think this is a good thing. We also, in principle, support development of public infrastructure. Of course, we see that that has the potential to contribute significantly to economic development in South Africa, poverty alleviation, and to be job creators in themselves. We are, of course, aware of these specific strategic integrated projects, and many of them are, in fact, designed to support the transition to a green economy. So we see those things. We see SIP 8, the green energy SIP. We see public transport in SIP 7. The social infrastructure SIPs 12, 13, 14, knowledge SIPs. There's even a potential, the water sanitation SIP 18, very important for us, and then also a potential SIP 19 of that is about investments in ecological infrastructure. So in principle, and it's very important for us to make this clear at the outset of the presentation, that we see a lot of the good things around the program of public infrastructure that is being rolled out. Having said all of that, we also don't believe it's particularly controversial to say that poorly conceived, ill-assessed, poorly assessed, not enough time to assess these projects properly could mean ecological disaster. It could mean further marginalization of communities, and it mean significant long-term costs for the state. It could also mean more litigation rather than less litigation. We spent quite a lot of time, and I'll just touch on it very briefly in the next slide, talking about the legal context. For us as environmental lawyers, of course, we work with this every day, but I'm sure a lot of the members don't deal with it, many of the legislation we work with every day. And we feel quite strongly, and we've made these comments repeatedly on the draft bill and on this bill, that we feel that a lot of the legal context and the existing policy commitments of government have been ignored in the drafting of this bill. We're worried about some constitutional rights and obligations that have been violated or at least threatened in this bill, particularly around administrative justice, but also around environmental rights. And then generally speaking, I guess our point is, and I'm sure this will not be the only organization making that point, is that where there are poor coordination and delays, and clearly that is in no one's interest, We don't believe that the best solution for that is through legislation. We think that there are other better ways of dealing with those problems. And in fact, I'm a little bit concerned by comments made earlier while we were sitting here listening about the EIA process, and it may be that all of that information has not yet been placed before this committee. So I'll touch on those as we go through the presentation. So we can talk about some specific concern, but also make some concrete recommendations, which I hope will be helpful to the committee. So in terms of legal context, of course, I expect all the members are very familiar with the Constitution and Section 24. Section 24, of course, is what we breathe and live. The first thing we think of when we wake up in the morning. And there's, of course, a very specific express reference to secure ecological, sustainable development and use of natural resources while promoting justifiable economic and social development in Section 24. Section 33 and Section 34 then deals with those procedural rights around just administrative action, access to courts. And then, of course, the other very important constitutional issue that we've raised in our submission around is about jurisdictional issues of municipalities and national provincial government. And noting that this bill has now been tagged, unlike previously, as a Section 75 bill. So we'll come back to those issues in a minute. Then, of course, there's the National Environmental Management Act and the National Environmental Management Principles. In the submission, the written submission, we've actually gone to quite a lot of trouble to set out the principles. I think we forget about these principles sometimes. This is law. This is applicable to every decision made by every organ of state. The design of all legislation, these principles must be taken into account. It's on paragraph sort of 18, 19. Of this, the written submission. Just to give you an example, some of the principles, the use and exploitation of non-renewable natural resources must be responsible and equitable, must take into account the consequences of the depletion of the resource. The precautionary principle that we see there on paragraph 19C6, Roman 6, that a risk-averse and cautious approach is applied, which takes into account the limits of current knowledge about the consequences of decisions and actions. The environmental justice must be pursued through it. Adverse environmental impact shall not be distributed in such a manner as to unfairly discriminate against any person, particularly vulnerable and disadvantaged persons. All consideration, I mean, there are a whole long list of things, very important consideration must be taken into account in all of these processes. The National Environmental Management Act itself, of course, and the EIA regulations that the members will be familiar with. As I was a bit concerned about comments made about that EIA regime here, it's very important to note that there are, and there have always been, time frames in the EIA regulations. Over the last 5 years, and probably specifically over the last 2 years, the Department of Environmental Affairs has spent a lot of time and energy improving the EIA regime, improving the turnaround time, the processing of EIA applications. I can only hope that they will themselves also come and make presentations here. I'm not sure they will. Sometime during last year, there was a whole parliamentary hearing before the Water and Environmental Affairs Committee about the efficacy of the EIA regime, where many of us came and made submissions about the system, what the good things were, what could be improved. And of course, as I referred to earlier, we had a lot of amendment bills last year. I think there were three National Environmental Management Act amendment bills, NEMLAB 1, 2, and 3, and many of them dealt with improvements to the EIA regime. For example, one of the big issues of discussion, I think it was in NEMLAB 3, guys, I can't remember which one, it was about setting time frames not only for authorities, which have for a long time been there, but also to create time frames and deadlines for applicants. Because the authorities will be the first to tell you that often the EIA process is slowed down by poor compliance and poor quality submissions made by applicants for developments. This is not a fact that I think gets enough airtime, because often the authorities take the blame for all of these things. So that is a new change that we see. There's also always been, and even more so now, remedy and recourse for those processes if they don't run smoothly. For example, in the latest bill, if the province doesn't process its EIA quickly enough, it can be escalated directly to the national minister, who will make a decision. These are all, you know, very important innovations that the department has developed and has consulted with the provinces to get their buy-in so that this can go through in amendments to the to NEMA. As far as I'm aware, there is in fact a special unit set up in the Department of Environmental Affairs to deal with these strategic integrated projects, to assist and facilitate a streamlined and a quicker processing of these applications. It kind of underscores the point we're trying to make, that a lot of these problems around it that are perceived, and I'm sure by many members here, perceived as delays in the EIA regime, are in fact being addressed and facilitated by the authorities. And they've really stepped, and we say this is a non-profit organization, not a government, we've really seen a significant change in the way that the department has dealt with these issues. The third bullet, just the last bullet point on legal context, is the issue of the constitutional court and how it's pronounced on issues of the jurisdictional issues. In the written submission, we've made reference to a number of cases around these jurisdictional issues. There have been just five very recent cases in the High Court, Supreme Court of Appeal, and Constitutional Court around the power of municipalities to do environmental planning as part of their function of municipal planning, which is something that's obviously of huge importance when you're designing a bill like the Infrastructure Development Bill. All right, then just stepping briefly to the issue of policy framework and commitments to sustainable development. We, as a country, we're kind of schizophrenic around sustainable development. We say that we really support sustainable development. We put it in our constitution. We like to see ourselves as leaders in this front. We host big conferences of the parties for the big international conventions. But the problem is that our actual decisions do not support these goals. Just recently, I think in December, the OECD published an environmental performance review for South Africa for 2013. And one of the very express conclusions they draw in there is that the plausibility of the identified targets we've set for ourselves is under strain given the policies in place to date. We're kind of shooting ourselves in the foot and making it impossible to meet our own targets around sustainable development. I mean, I won't go into detail. The members here will be very familiar with the documents I referred to, the Outcome 10 Delivery Agreement, that specifically recognised how in the past we haven't taken into account of the damage that we caused through ill-conceived economic development. I'm sure many people here will know about the issues of acid mine drainage that we see in Gauteng, in the northwest, in Mpumalanga, and the incredible cost to the fiscus that has created. National Strategy on Sustainable Development, approved by Cabinet, that document, and sets very specific priorities for sustainable development. And of course, the National Development Plan itself also speaks very clearly around the commitments and how we can achieve sustainable development. These issues are not in this entire bill, in the entire infrastructure development, there's not a single reference to sustainable development, to ecosystems, to climate change, to the resilience of our environment, to actually support the people and the people who rely on the environmental services that we get. So, you know, that's in fact the very first primary concern we want to raise. You know, for us working on this every day, we were distressed to read this bill and find a massive bill that sets out government's plans around infrastructure rollout to see not a single reference to sustainable development. It's like it's 20 years ago for us. The second point we want to make, and I'm sure we'll hear from other people as well, is the issue of the time frames and conflicts with legislation. And this, I guess, is kind of a problem of bringing a new legislative regime on top of an existing regime. The bill, as we understand it, sets certain time frames, says that time frames may not be exceeded, but doesn't take into account the complexities of the EIA process, the rights that arise from the EIA process, for example, appeal rights that might occur, particularly in a rushed EIA process, which is what you see here. And here we see, we take the biggest projects. I mean, SIP 1 is a massive, massive bundle of projects in the Waterberg. Those are the ones we want to fast track instead of spending more time on looking at the impact on people, on the environment, on water resources. So for us, that is of major concern. Goodness, am I out of time already? I'm passionate about it. Okay, so shall I just summarise, Chair, or would you like me to? Sure, I'll be as quick as I can. I guess the other very crucial point to raise here is actually around, I think, public consultation. I think I've heard that mentioned here earlier today as well. So that, of course, is very concerning to us. We've dealt with that in our written submission. But the other big issue is the issue of the administrative law interventions and the way environmental administrative justice is compromised by the structures in the bill. So we've given an example there. This is the consequence of bringing all these government authorities into one committee and making them essentially find a way to approve a development. So, for example, I think we used an example of the Department of Water Affairs and said, how does the Department of Water Affairs refuse an application for a water use license where inadequate water resources are available for a particular project, having been part of a steering committee whose main purpose includes to identify ways and means of giving effect to the Commission's decision to implement a strategic integrated project, and in so doing to ensure prompt compliance with all applicable laws. It is extremely difficult, if not impossible, for a government official in that situation to exercise an independent mind that is required by administrative law to make the right decisions in terms of their own mandate under the National Water Act, when everything else around them, and even the bill itself, says we must make this happen, we must facilitate this, and we must approve this. So from a legal point of view, as lawyers, we are very concerned about it, and we say this because we think that there's grounds for challenge of those decisions. And if we're trying to avoid unnecessary litigation around this, I think this is going to be a problem for the bill. Chair, the necessary changes to the bill pretty much follow on the consequences we raised, so I won't talk about that. I'll just conclude by referring to some writing we've done on this bill. If the members are interested, it's on our website. There's a link to, you can find that in your in the printout of the PowerPoint presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Forrest, for the presentation on behalf of Center for Environmental Rights. We always welcome such a presentation. Members, this is a presentation. May we interact with it? Dr. Mahai, Dr. Yukman, Dr. Mabasa, Baba Kwankwa, the fund of this meeting, we'll do that order.
Thanks, Chairperson. I agree with the presenter, Ms. Fori, that the principal law of the country, or the supreme law of the country, is our constitution. Constitution is the basis that our unfolding process of transformation is anchored. And two, that part of what is raised in the bill under discussion is that the bill has to assist us to facilitate projects that can drive development and inclusive growth. It's very critical. My understanding of the SIPs as well is that these are projects that are elevated, that have proven through feasibility studies or business case, that are elevated at the national scale. That SIP, when you say project, is a strategic project which serves various policy objectives. Surely it emerges out of a process. I know one, the project that is called the Devon Free State Gauteng Logistic and Industrial Corridor. I'm just citing a project because I'm from Free State. I know that this project was a priority in the municipality, was a priority in the provincial government, so does the national policy on logistics defines an importance of building corridors for strategic economic growth and development. So it cuts across and it doesn't pose any risk in terms of environment. As we said earlier, they do reinforce even environmental friendly atmosphere. Development does promote environment. I subscribe to that school of thought. So I do not understand where are serious risks, the underlying factors that poses risks, if we strengthen capacity to coordinate and supervise development, like this bill suggests to me. As you said, that the learned friends are concerned on some of the underlying factors that may pose as risk. Could you shed light, maybe? Where does the danger lies in a proposal which appears so much clearer that it only seeks to strengthen coordination and technical ability to implement? Thanks.
Thanks, Dr. Mohai. Mr. Friedman? I guess we're the next one.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation. I just want to have clarification on one statement in the main presentation. We said that the bill would also violate international obligations. If the presenter can just indicate examples of those things.
Thank you. Mr. Koko.
Mr. Mohai covered my question. Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Van der Westen.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would just like to ask, first want to say to the presenter, thank you very much, and I think you've been here, perhaps here, and you've been listening to other presenters, and it seems to me there's a recurring theme in many of the presentations that we've received this morning, and I'm convinced that the department will be taking note of what you've said. My question is just how do we resolve some of it, and thank you, I see you've made some constructive proposals as well. Can you please comment on the following? Would it assist if we say that such a strategic infrastructure project should actually only be undertaken once the environmental authorization has been obtained? Because, you know, a project is often a multi-year thing, and I can imagine that, you know, the purpose of this bill is really to coordinate different role players, etc., whereas the environmental authorization is limited to a fairly, you know, individual organ of state, and that perhaps doesn't need to be coordinated with other planning processes to the extent that, say, for example, you will find in the construction, financing, etc. states. So if you could just comment on perhaps separating that part of, you know, a project from the other management responsibilities. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Van der Westen. Babunda.
Thanks, Chairperson, and I'd like to welcome the presentation. I also, Chairperson, say I was broadly covered by Honorable Mohai. But I want to check with the presenter. Are you happy with the pace the infrastructure development is going in this country? Are you satisfied that, no, we are not being delayed by some other obstacles? I know that this is your competence about the environment, but taking into account development, I mean, of the infrastructure in the whole country, what is your take? Are you satisfied that it is going at a sufficient pace?
Thanks. I'm sorry, Mabasa. May you come in then?
No, my question is, there is a point when the marginalization of poor communities was implied. If more flesh could be given to that, to say how do we come to that observation. And then there is another point that says that the existing acts are ignored. You know, is it that they are ignored, or is it that of slow delivery, we must come with an instrument to hasten delivery. Because if that doesn't happen, it means we will not go anywhere. But my last point is, will you not agree with me that sometimes environmental interests, correctly as environmental interests, could also hamper development, especially in the sense of road construction, rail, you know, so that a balance needs to be struck. Otherwise, we will end up with an environment, a country of environment, beautiful environment, but with no jobs. And just to make an extreme example, some of the countries that claim to be more environmentalist have already eaten all their lions and their elephants. And it is us here in Africa who are still having these creatures of nature, you know. So you can say, where did their natural animals go? Is it not that they exhumed and destroyed them? And after that, they claim we are more backward, you know. Thanks, Correction.
Thank you very much, Babu Mabasa. How long should be the process of the environmental impact assessment take? For instance, in your own opinion, that you might think is reasonable, for instance, enough, and you'll consider it having, you know, being taken care of, the issues that you've raised. I think my colleagues have actually alluded to the fact that this bill doesn't need to, or is not meant to actually derail. It's actually meant to fast track. But that doesn't mean that it should ignore the existing legislation or undermine the existing legislation as it is purported here. It merely says the status quo as it is now doesn't make, you know, things to happen as they should be. Hence, we need to ensure that instead of spending 5 days in planning or in processing, we should spend 2 days. That's exactly what it says. But doesn't mean that other legislative frameworks in place or regulations in place should be overlooked. It doesn't say that at all. It mainly says, let's streamline, let's align, let's coordinate properly, let's cooperate better. And where there's conflict, let's resolve, let's have a conflict resolution mechanism that could ensure that there is progress made. This is what it is saying. So that at the end of the day, there's speedy delivery of services. People can have water, people can have roads, people can have transport, alternative modes of transport, you know, in a minimum required time, unlike what is happening currently. And I don't see anywhere where it says we're going to undermine the efforts or the functions and powers of municipalities, of the provincial governments, because it also recognizes the fact that there is intergovernmental relation, a legislation or framework in place, and that should be considered. We don't see anything that talks contrary to that. What it's mainly saying, as some of my colleagues have indicated, that let's ensure that we do things in a different manner, and so that we don't spend years and years planning and talking, consulting forever. Let's make sure that we minimize time spent on planning and implementing projects. So that's why I'm asking, what exactly would you think it is a reasonable, you know, time frame to be spent, for instance, in doing EIA, doing other assessments that are needed, for instance, whether it's the due diligence in terms of some of the projects that needs to be done. And what do you, would you say, for instance, that because most of the environmentalists would say, would prefer the preservation of environment as against development. And looking at how, you know, development has evolved over a period of time, would you say that we would be where we are today if we had, for instance, we haven't, you know, taken decisions that we have taken in South Africa, and not only South Africa, but also the other countries that are today called developed countries. I'm not saying we should completely disregard, but shouldn't we talk balancing here instead of really stalling development? Over to you, ma'am.
Charles, this is a huge set of very challenging questions, and it really goes to kind of the essence of the complexities of sustainable development, many of the questions asked, including the one just posed by the chair. I think the debate around environmental preservation versus development for us in the environmental sector, and it's also important to remember, of course, that we, you know, in the environmental sector are not homogenous. There are lots of different opinions and different views about these issues, but I think it would be safe to say, as the centre, which kind of moves in the middle of that sector, that we are, that debate is pretty much over. I think there is still room for certain types of preservation, conservation in protected areas, but generally speaking, the debate that we have is not about that. It's about looking at ecological infrastructure. How can we continue economic development while ensuring that there will still be natural resources left for children, our children, and future generations, so that our children could still go see those elephants and lions and rhinos that have disappeared. They're not going to be in the streets like they used to be ever again, clearly. But I think that debate has evolved enormously in the last 20 years, since the 1980s, early 1990s, with the kind of development of the concept of sustainable development. And in fact, our Constitutional Court has spoken about what it means and on a number of occasions. So if anything that I said in the submission came across as talking about preserving at the expense of the economic development, it's not intended to be like that, because I don't think that any of us really believe that. To respond to the chair's question about how long should the process take, it's an incredibly difficult question. Of course, the answer is it depends. It depends on what the proposal is, what the nature of the assessment is that must be done. And to some degree, you know, there's only so much that people can do. You can talk about doing something in 2 days and 5 days, but ultimately it takes time. A typical big EIA application will be files and files and files of scientific studies to be assessed. So you can put it in front of an official and say, make a decision in 3 days, but they can't make a proper decision like that. Many of the studies can't be done in such a short period. Some studies around, for example, water resources. I mean, we've done a lot of work around the Vele Colliery in Limpopo, for example, where you've got a Limpopo River that doesn't run the whole year round. So when you're taking data and you're doing stats about water availability and water quality, it differs enormously from season to season. So if you do it in wintertime, there'll be no water, and if you do it in summertime, there'll be floods. And to say that you're going to do an environmental impact assessment in 250 days almost per definition means that that data will not be available to you. You know, it's interesting, there are a number of other countries, including other developing countries in South America, for example, and that takes to the question of the Honourable Member about whether you should first have an environmental authorisation before you approve projects for the rest of the development of the project. In South American countries, I think there's one in, I think it's in Chile, where they require 5 years of scientific data to be available before you can approve a project. 5 years of scientific data. In South Africa, we don't think like that. We think 250 days from beginning to end, then the thing must be going. And the problem is that if you get it wrong, the impact can be absolutely horrendous. We have a number of big white elephant projects in South Africa that are standing there that can't be used, that are costing a lot of money, dams that have silted up, a lot of extra expense that had to be incurred because of poor impact assessments. So how long should a process take? It really, really and totally depends on the project. You know, when we're dealing with a large project, however, you would expect it to be take longer, but not necessarily. I mean, we heard the reference to a road corridor. Maybe that kind of project would be easier than a big open cast coal mine. So it really does depend. And I mean, again, you understand that we at the centre are lawyers, we're not scientists, so you really should ask those sort of questions of scientists. I think it's important also to remember that many environmental projects or projects that are well conceived and properly undertaken in compliance with the law are in fact job creators. So it's not a question of preserving environment at the cost of employment. If you look, for example, at the enormous number of unrehabilitated mines we have in South Africa, I've forgotten now, I think the number is something like, can you remember, 3,000? I'll have to check that. A huge number. The Department of Mineral Resources is rehabilitating at the rate of about 5 per year. Can you imagine the job creation that sits in enforcing those obligations to rehabilitate those mines and the work that needs to be done there? It's an incredible opportunity for our country. So I think that's also an important thing to remember throughout. This is not necessarily one over the other, but it's potentially a huge job creator in our country. And of course, the members here would be aware of programs like Working for Water, Working for Wetlands, that have employed many, many hundreds and thousands of people. With fantastic results for the environment. They've had radical impact on the availability of water resources in our country. I think I must address, most importantly, the question about the existing acts, whether they've been ignored. And I took the chair's point about that of course the bill is not intended to slow down. It's intended to kind of facilitate and speed up these kind of decisions. I think the question was also whether we're satisfied with the pace of infrastructure development. Those are, in my mind, sort of related questions. I mean, I think it's correct to say that the bill doesn't expressly undermine, doesn't expressly contradict legislation. I'm not even sure that's correct. I think it does, in fact, contradict existing legislation. When it says the entire process must be completed in 250 days and it may not be exceeded, you are already contradicting existing EIA legislation, the NEMA and the EIA regulations expressly in terms of the time frames. So I think the current regime that we're working with, which has been the work of the Mining and Environmental Affairs Committees for the last year, is looking at a 300-day period, which again, we'll argue in certain cases won't be enough. But they're working on a 300-day period, and that's the regulations they're working on. So expressly, that 250 days is contradicting existing legislation. And the problem is if it's not resolved and dealt with in the legislation expressly, there will be litigation. And that, again, will slow down the rollout of SIPs, which is not the intention. So it's, you know, from our point of view, we really think that it's worth looking at that and seeing if there are better ways to align the provisions of this bill with existing legislation. Those two committees, I must say, really have done a lot of work the last year to try to streamline and integrate all the licenses for environment, mining, water, environmental assessment, waste, and air quality licenses. So they've done a huge amount of work. There's flowcharts, everything's available. So there's no express reason why this regime in here should not just start up with that. I think that should be a fairly easy task.
I will have to stop. We've exceeded actually with about 15 minutes. As we have requested others, we'll do the same too, that please, we request that you forward us for some of the responses in writing. If you can do so within the next 7 days, you really have assisted us. Maybe I need to indicate why, because the procedure dictates that after this public hearing, after the next 7 days, the minister will have to come back to us and respond, tell us exactly why, what he thinks about your comments, whether he still feels the bill is okay as it is, or he feels there are certain things that he might agree with you on. And then if you have not submitted those, you know, some of those responses might, you know, they might not be considered, and you may find that there are very important issues that need really to be also reflected in the bill. So it is important that we get those submissions. Otherwise, thank you very much for your time and your presentation, and the fact that you also had showed some interest in this act. And then for your passion for keeping our environment, I can see the passion as you talk. Thank you very much. May we then welcome the next presenter from the Legal Aid? Oh, from the Community Grow. Okay. Thank you, the lady and gentleman from Community Grow. Mr. David Pearson, who's the CEO, will be leading. Ms. Gita Gavin, who's the chairperson, and Mr. Adrian Boyson, who's the Chief Strategic Officer. May I hand over to you?
Thank you very much. I will open.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon to everyone. We welcome this opportunity to make this presentation to you, and I'd like to start off with just introducing ourselves. I'm the chairperson of Community Grow, and I just want to flash this newspaper headline briefly. To indicate that it's a momentous occasion for us today to be addressing you and presenting towards your bill, in that we have received the announcement in the press from Minister Bridell for the amendment to the urban edge for the City of Cape Town. That has very, very big implications in terms of large-scale projects, integration, and inclusive development. So, very quickly then, if I can introduce the rest of the people here. David Pearson is from PAC Developers and also the CEO of Community Grow, and he's the originator of the project that we're about to share with you. Adrian Boyson is the Chief Strategic Officer for Community Grow, and he will also be speaking. Now, For the last 30 years, there are five companies that I have been associated with that have been working earnestly in making a difference towards affordable housing, sustainable housing, and the delivery of public architecture. We've been involved in the struggle, in advocacy, in policy, in practice, and particularly in the delivery of successful projects. And over that time, we've struggled with the possibility of delivering our commitment to integrated and inclusive development. But along the way, we have learned many lessons. So 7 years ago, David Pearson originated the project that we're about to share. And 3 years ago, these five companies came together. And we put our heads together and realized that if we worked differently and if we thought differently, we could begin to generate solutions that really capture the kinds of things that we have fought for in the new democracy. So Community Grow is the agency that was born through that coming together of those five companies. What has been very interesting is that over the last few years, gradually there has come to be a greater alignment between what we were developing as an approach to development and the practical project development that we were working on, and key pieces of policy and legislation, and Adrian will talk to that just now. It's also very interesting for us, and it's a happy day today, that some of those alignments come together in this kind of opportunity to have a conversation, so that we can really address the opportunity to create integrated city development for all. And we're talking about integrated city development for all in the context of knowing very well what the kind of challenges are of informal settlements, sprawl, affordable housing, etc. So what we welcome is the opportunity to explore with you this possibility of working at scale, working together. We have to work together. We've got to pool our resources because the challenges are large. And most importantly, that we build on the alignments and synergies that are beginning to become much more possible to bring together. So with that, I'm going to hand over to Adrian. Can I have the first slide, please, Adrian? Just briefly to say
that just before you continue, I must indicate you only have 15 minutes,
sure,
including the 5 minutes you've spent,
sure,
of
thank
the
you.
3 minutes and 2 seconds. Yes, thank
okay.
you.
Okay, so Community Grow works through six pillars, health, homes, governance, education, economy, and regenerative systems design. That's looking at how the environment can regenerate itself and how infrastructure works with that. We are a private company, but we are a social enterprise model, and our focus is on addressing all of the aspects that are needed to create functional urban environments. And most importantly, our focus is on building communities, building sustainable communities from the neighborhood level right up to the city level. So then I'll hand over to Adrian.
Pilot project is Westgate, which today we have just witnessed the approval or the announcement from the province, Cape Town province, Western Cape province, to move the urban edge of the city of Cape Town to include that project. Westgate is substantial. It's a 3,100 acre site. It has been planned along the natural growth corridor for the city of Cape Town. And initially, it was non-productive agricultural land which fell outside of the urban edge of the city of Cape Town. What we've done is brought together the built environment, services, and social infrastructure to be able to deliver this project. To give you an idea of the scale of it, high-level projections at this stage are 200,000 households. That allows 800,000 residents, 300,000 jobs, 120 schools, 200 creches, 20 primary clinics, 8 secondary clinics, community centers, sports grounds, police stations, and hospitals. We have looked at every aspect of society in delivering what we believe to be an urban solution to the South African landscape. How do we transition all of these aspects to an urban economy? Firstly, identifying the land which is on a natural growth corridor. We basically go through project design, which covers land acquisition, bulk services infrastructure, which we, with our engineers, design hand-in-hand with the city of Cape Town, but we finance. internal services infrastructure, the construction of the project, urban management and utility systems, ICT and transport systems, and the green environment. A very distinct advantage of the capability that design brings is that we are dealing with a new project, which means that we are not talking to existing infrastructure to try and re-enhance that so that it has capability to meet the demand. We're going to project implementation, which then goes to building an urban economy, which is we build the homes, the education facilities, the healthcare facilities, civic and facilities and amenities, and also combined with that, because we have a national consumer market, then bring in industrial and commercial activity across a range of sectors. It's important for us that we locate this within a green, walkable, urban node-based settlement, where you have urban nodes that basically comprise and make up this whole urban settlement. Utilities, networks, and systems, a very strong advantage of new technology, and because these are new developments, is that we can use green technology, we can use things that are at the forefront of creating modern societies that are technologically advanced, and we deploy those into our projects. Our objectives, which then emanate from being in social enterprise, is that we have a local consumer market that we have housed, we have provided facilities, social facilities for education and healthcare, and we provide the economic opportunities that make up Westcape as an urban center. So there are jobs that emanate from the social aspects, social infrastructure, which are the education facilities and the health facilities, also on the urban management side, going through to transport, ICT, and then just general business. Our objective is to have decent jobs, sustainable jobs, and permanent jobs based within a learning economy. So if we add all of those together, we are basically taking a very critical success factor for us, which is converse, and which is the only way you can work in the private sector, is that prior to us developing policy or plan, we identify what resources and skills we do have. Based on the resources and skills that we have, we then take our concept and then we initiate the project. The second thing is that we use non-linear processes, which create dynamic, holistic delivery. So we are then enabled to provide a solution, a holistic solution, with the end in sight. And that way achieve our delivery objectives. Functionally, from a sociological point of view, what happens in this environment is we create an aspirational communal mindset. People have access to work, they have access to decent education and healthcare, all within a community-based green environment. That leaves us then with an integrated urban economy which is sustainable and which can then regenerate itself. A critical part of this, and probably one of the most important points, is that this can be replicated. We can replicate it locally, we can replicate it in Africa. Currently we are busy in Ghana. We have had meetings with the government of Uganda at the Prime Minister level. And there's probably a 2,000 hectare project on the go in Ghana that we would try and roll out or start implementing this year's form. Just to set scale for Westgate, it's important to note that, and we've probably just chosen one of the mega projects that have been part of the South African media landscape for a long time, which is the Kusile Power Plant. Westgate's 3,100 hectares, roughly double the size of Kusile site.
Without really sounding very bad, I just wanted you to focus more on the wheel.
Okay.
I know you're busy as a company doing some of these things, but we're just more interested in what is your feel around the bill and what would be your recommendations in as far as the bill is concerned.
Sure. With respect, Madam Chair, I'm just trying
we
to set the premise here.
We don't have time because you already exhausted your 15 minutes. And this should be then, I should be giving members an opportunity to ask questions.
Okay.
In relation to your comments.
Yes.
On the bill.
If we can then just cut to the chase and just, I'll go straight to the recommendations on the next 3 minutes.
Yes, can you do so within the next 3 minutes?
Okay, I'll go. So basically what we're addressing, and we are cognizant of the contents of the bill, and also that we have taken our model, and our model is perfectly timed and aligned at scale with the bill, but also the National Development Plan, National Infrastructure Plan, and the New Growth Path. In terms of where the bill has gone, in terms of its object, we are basically aligned and in sync with the object. We endorse it 100%. What we don't find in the bill is private sector applicability. The bill speaks directly to state-led projects. It overlooks the potential applicability to us, especially in terms of mega infrastructure projects at the level of Westgate, as an example, which is a 140 billion rand project. Also, in terms of Schedule 1 of the bill, we address in Westgate alone at least 10 of the 17 identified project types. Second to that is we are absorbing all of the risk. There's no risk-sharing mechanism. As a completely private sector initiative, we are arranging the finance. We are doing this on a completely business-premised basis. An enabling regulatory environment as proposed by the bill, and this is where our endorsement for the bill comes in, is that we have just gone through the urban edge process. Has been a process that's taken us 2 years. If we go into rezoning now, that's going to take us at least another 3 years. It's not a very good enabling environment for us to attract investment and maintain the feasibility of the project. We are also by default, as somebody who's going to develop a large-scale human settlement, an integrated human settlement, we have a PPP with the City of Cape Town on the basis that bulk services infrastructure that we finance and maintain will be handed over to them as fixed assets over time. Our recommendations are then clearly as follows. We would like to see clear mechanisms instituted in the bill to provide for submission and approval of private sector SIPs, so that we can also access the bill as an enabler for strategic, integrated, and high economic impact projects. Experienced business sector, non-conflicted steering committee participation is also something that we would recommend and propose to see. To guide the business premise decision making, business people at a high level and also with a significant amount of experience would have a kind of contribution that would assist in making business premise decisions in line with the current regulatory environment. And lastly, in terms of recommendation one, we would like to see the PICC have a mechanism that allows the review of private sector concepts that is aligned with the bill, where they can take a generic model like the one that Community Grow has built and take that and mandate it as something that can be rolled out nationally. And lastly, basically in terms of incentivizing the private sector is absorbing all of the risk. We are absorbing all of the opportunity cost in looking at purely profit-driven things. We have heeded a call to action to work in collaboration with government, all 3 tiers of government, to deliver proper urban cities. And we then would like to recommend that tax incentives are explored by National Treasury, and that preferential access to funding be explored, which has been in discussion for a really long time, by way of DFIs and state mandatory retirement funds. And lastly, a clear process and for equitable risk share to be developed and instituted in the bill. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Is that Mr. Poisson?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Poisson. Colleagues, I guess this was quite straightforward in terms of recommendations and the areas of concern. May we then interact, Mr. Pickman, Babu Mabasa, Babu Mdao, that order, please.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you very much for the presentation. I just want to maybe a practical example, and maybe you can expand on that. You've indicated that you've got now the go-ahead for the urban edge to be lifted, and you've indicated there's now a 2 year, in terms of the current statutory requirements, there's a 2 year process for the rezoning. I just want to give the indication, if we stay with the current legislative framework, how long will it take? That's now rezoning and all those other approvals. And if we, on the other hand, is going to use this bill as the vehicle, what will be your time assessment? Can you just give us a short answer?
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Colleague Chair. I just want to test my interpretation of your input. I get the impression that you appreciate the presence of this bill that is introduced. And that the areas that you are pointing out are merely areas that will enhance and improve the bill. So seeing that, seeing you nodding in that manner, then I will ask you to comment, because you know, another purpose of hearings like this is to make sure that it's not just an interaction between ourselves and yourselves, but it's an interaction between all the parties. So if there are points that you want to comment on, which are informed by the broader inputs that have been made by other participants, I will appreciate that, having made the premise that I have made. And thanks for the points that you've made. Thanks, Colleague.
Thank you, Babu Mabasa. Babu Mudau.
Thank you, Chair. You probably saw me crease my forehead several times as we were talking, because like the chair was sort of trying to get, where's the connection? Now I got the connection. But I want to ask you a question which will link with the previous question. If this bill was an act, how would it impact on your model? What would be the things that could be done and what would be the things that couldn't be done, so that we can appreciate what you say?
Thanks, Babu Mudau. Any other? Thank you very much. I have a question also. I have an impression that the private sector has a lot of money. If put together, could really make a great impact in the development of our country. You have what you call the, what is it, community investment, social responsibility kind of thing. That money, if you look at all the companies existing in South Africa, we can talk billions and billions of money. Don't you think if that money could be put together, it might make a difference and allow the private sector to together move in a consolidated manner, you know, in trying to assist in alleviating or in perhaps even moving in parallel with the public sector. Do you believe that could be done? Maybe as part of your addition to your model. I think it's quite clear that we have a triple P. That's how much government believes in the public-private partnership model. Hence we have the triple P unit within the Treasury. And Treasury being part of the cluster that developed this bill, I guess it is quite clear that government is also willing to take the private sector on board in terms of, and the fact that it says it gives the commission, which is led by the president, the power to designate projects, therefore means that that there's a possibility or potential of also taking the private sector, you know, the consensus you've raised from the private sector point of view into consideration. So these questions are trying to make you look at things differently, or perhaps to ignite, you know, something within you to find, you know, a response in a way from yourself now that you have such information, if you didn't have before. I know that one of the colleagues asked the question if the bin was now an act and you have these modules in place, how would you, for instance, see yourself fitting? I was also interested in that kind of a question because from the way we see things, this is how we feel that you should be coming in as after this bill has been done, to say this is how we see things and this is also how we feel we should, you know, be participating, you know, to ease the burden of government in the whole implementation of infrastructure in the country. I'm just asking this question differently so that you can be able to also perhaps change your perspective in some of the concerns that you've raised.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
May I then hand over to you?
Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you. And this bill is really welcome. You know, with the global recession that we've experienced in the last 6-7 years, in the countries where there were failing banks, they introduced quantitative easing. And essentially, that's stimulus packages. And finally, we've got a stimulus package that's being proposed. That's what this bill is about. It's making it easier for the economy to basically ramp up and start creating the jobs that we need. What we have done, and by way of example, unfortunately my colleague wasn't able to explain the example between what we were proposing and one of the other mining projects, but I just want to read something that was in the Asian Development Bank publication about 2-3 years ago. And arguably, Singapore has been the prime example in the world of actually stimulating an economy. And it says, growth essentially comes from within a region or sub-region's intellectual allocation of human, physical, and intellectual capital. Simply supply-side economic investment, as an example, infrastructure, offers little benefit when pursued in isolation of other activities. So what we don't want and what we're proposing is that there is this close interaction with the private sector, the government, as somebody explained, through all tiers and spheres, so that what you're actually getting is this interacted, interconnected stimulus package that benefits everybody. So, Madam Chair, your question about the private sector has lots of money. I started this 7 years ago. I tried to speak to everybody. And I can tell you, for one, that I really look forward to working with conglomerates in this country that are bound by their social commitment to this country. Because without government intervention like this bill, which will really pave the way to opening up stimulus, because it's often the have-nots that are trying to drive the social commitment. Change happens from the bottom up, not from the top down. So, and the Financial Services Charter went away in trying to actually stimulate that. But those same people that are offering Financial Services Charter funding require such exorbitant IRR rates of return that it's very difficult to meet when you're trying to do a social project. Social project and triple P have become swear words, certainly in South Africa. And we need to restore the belief in those things. So I agree with you that something needs to happen. And by way of this bill, in terms of streamlining our processes, in terms of EIA processes, somebody asked the question earlier, what would it do in terms of, if this bill was enacted already, what would it do for your project? It would do two things. It'll help with funding, number one, and number two, it will ensure that our feasibilities that we do today don't run into cost problems 3, 4, 5, 6 years down the line. So we support this bill wholeheartedly, but we would like to interface with the portfolio committee, with the supervisors of this particular funding at a later stage so that the private sector can access the bill. Just by way of example, and then I'm finished, we currently have 2.3 million houses waiting to be delivered by families. They desperately need those homes. This is 200,000 homes that we are looking to provide. This is privately funded. We'd love the stimulus of the funding. We'd like the fast tracking of the bill to assist us. 200,000 houses in 9 provinces, that's 1.8 million homes. Westgate provides 300,000 permanent jobs. Times 9, that's 2.7 million jobs. That's a 170 billion rand project that requires a peak funding of less than 10 billion rand. Now that's what the private sector can do. So I'd just like to thank the minister and the portfolio committee for bringing forward this bill to the extent that they have, because this infrastructure bill, together with the NDP, together with the DTI, speaks to 15 of the 20 concerns that we've dealt with in integrating this model. Thank you.
Thank you very much. With regard to the EIA question and the rezoning question, our experience has been that at the city level, the official capacity to deal with some of these submissions is very limited. And if the bill can somehow facilitate boosting that capacity, it would really help, because a project of this nature requires quite a lot of processing. So very directly, that would speed up some of those processes, because we've experienced and we've discussed with them that they are straining to deal with all of the demands and from a project level. I think also that some of our EIA processes are trying to preserve or conserve existing environments, whereas we should actually be looking at evolutionary environments. And if we look from that frame, we would actually be addressing the whole process a little bit differently. So that's also something we would like to discuss with you further if the opportunity arises. And I believe that in that way, we could actually tighten some of those processes. We don't want to sidestep any of those processes, but we want to find more efficient ways of actually moving together so that we can pull that time down from 33 years to about 2 years or 2.5 years. And I believe that that could be possible if we look at it more tightly. Similarly, with the question of the funding, if we create a risk-sharing framework, I think that we have a project procedural framework inside of which the risk-sharing framework would actually allow us to anticipate the time delays in landing the funding in order to facilitate the actual work that needs to happen.
Thank you very much. I think we've learned a lot from the community GROW. I don't know how to pronounce it.
Community.
It is community. Okay. Community GROW. I think we've also learned a lot from your model. I think we'll have to still look at it so that we can be able to understand and see whether members of parliament here can't also want to implement it somewhere. Thank you very much for your time and for your interest in this public hearing, and your submission also helps a lot.
Madam Chair, sorry, just 1 second. You mentioned that maybe other people would be interested. You know, we did this, it took us 7 years. It's a free download on the website for everybody. This is a 360-page book that we wrote when we did this project. And this is a replicable model that we've taken into Africa. It's 2 billion strong, because by 2050 they're going to be 2 billion strong Africans. And we're going to need 800 new cities, and this is a model for new cities. It's a free download on the book, on the website. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I'll pardon you for, because you're coming up with a very progressive thing. In Parliament, after the presiding officer has spoken, nobody else speaks. Okay, thank you very much for that. You had, it's a free download. Make sure that you get that thing for your own information, and because information is power. You can also, it can also enhance your understanding of certain issues. Thank you very much, gentlemen and lady. Colleagues, I guess we've worked hard today. Would you agree with me?
Yeah.
Do you want to call it a day? Okay. I think you'll be pleased to know that even though it's sad, I'm sad because I would have loved to hear from these three presenters. But unfortunately, they apologized. That is the Legal Resource Center, the Center for Civil Society and Psyche. We don't know the reasons for them not coming, but they did apologize. I think we must put it on record that they were given an opportunity to present, but they showed an interest, but later on apologized, which then gives us a time to go and read and do more reading, actually, so that tomorrow we can come prepared. Thank you very much for your attendance and your participation in today's session. We'll see you tomorrow. We're meeting again at Afros 9, and we'll also be looking at another 11 presentations. So tomorrow all of them have confirmed, and we're hoping that we'll be able to make up for today. Thank you very much. This hearing stands adjourned. Thank you.